Sethan revolt being led by Mattathias and by his family. Mattathias being of a priestly family. His son Judas Maccabeus lending his support to the revolt when Mattathias died. Judas Maccabeus being given that nickname, Maccabeus, which means the hammer, Judas the hammer. Judah or Judas the hammer, and he died early on in the conflict. I think in 161 BC he died. And then his brothers carried on the conflict. And finally, the youngest surviving brother is the one who actually gains the power and the throne, so to speak. And on the timeline that you have, it's a date about 141 BC or something along those lines when the Hasmonean dynasty comes into being. I want you to notice this little line here because it's kind of important to the point that I want to make. The Hasidians were people who wanted to continue in the traditions of the fathers. That is to say, they wanted to continue with the temple worship. They wanted to continue with following the law of Moses. They wanted to continue with all of the rules and rituals associated with clean and unclean foods and all of that. They wanted to support that. They were willing to put their lives on the line for all of that. But as happens in many revolutions, and we have examples of it in our own century, as happens in many revolutions, once the revolution is done, the people who've won the revolution sometimes don't carry through on the ideals that they themselves have espoused. And so we have coming out of the Hasidians, the Hasmoneans, who are the ruling party in the separate kingdom that the Jews enjoyed during about an 80-year period from about 140 to 60 BC, or 141 or 2 to about 63 BC when the Romans invade the land. The Hasmoneans started out as the Hasidians. And somebody asked what happened to the Hasidians. Well, basically what happened is several different movements really came out of that original ideal of keeping pure, of being pious and faithful and following the way of the Lord. One of the parties that came out of them were the Hasmoneans, the priest kings who ruled at that time. And they became, over the course of a couple of generations, very autocratic, very selfish, and very abusive toward their fellow Jews. They waged a war against the Samaritans. I do not remember if I mentioned this yesterday. They waged a war against the Samaritans in an effort to expand their territory. And when the woman at Sychar in the fourth chapter of John is talking to Jesus, and she says, our fathers worshipped, past tense, our fathers worshipped God on this mountain. She's at Mount Gerizim. Sychar is right there at Mount Gerizim. And the Samaritans had a temple on Mount Gerizim until the Hasmoneans conquered them and destroyed their temple. And said, as the woman relates to Jesus, but you Jews say we must worship in Jerusalem. And they had enforced that with the sword. And of course, the Samaritans had not really acquiesced in that direction. And there was enduring hostility between the Samaritans and the Jews that wasn't just a hostility based on philosophy, but was a hostility based on combat and oppression in the past. Likewise, as we go down the line here, when we have the Romans coming into the scene here, we have the development as the Hasmonean party loses their power. We have them replaced by, but really not replaced by so much as developing into, the Sadducean party. They are the heirs of the priest kings. They are those who support the priestly party of the Jews. In the New Testament, Luke makes the point to us in the book of Acts that the Sadducees are those who are the high priest and his associates. The chief priests are the ones who are the Sadducees. They are the ruling elite. That is, they had been the ruling elite during the Maccabean period, and they continued to be the ones who had the wealth and power in the Roman period. So the Sadducees come out of the dominion of the Hasmoneans. They were the supporters of the priest kings that ruled in Judea. It's a little bit controversial to put the Essenes over here where I put them, and not that you care about that particular controversy, but in scholarly circles it would be a little bit controversial to put the Essenes in this place, but I'm persuaded from the things that I have heard and the things that I've read that that's correct. The Essenes split off of the priestly party during the Maccabean period, probably around 100 years B.C. or so. The Essenes split off from the Sadducean party because they weren't getting their fair share of everything. And so they started on an effort of reformation, which really ended up in them abandoning Jerusalem, setting up a commune down by the Dead Sea at Qumran, as well as various enclaves scattered over the land of Judah and the Galilee. But they probably came out of the Essenes, and they wanted to purify the priesthood. Meanwhile, as the Sadducees arise as supporters of the Hasmonean priest kings, the Pharisees arise And they are really, in a sense, the true heirs of the Hasidians, although the Hasmoneans, their direct ancestors in terms of genealogy, had been Hasidians. The Pharisees are really the true heirs that grow out of the Hasidian movement of the previous generations. And they're the ones who take the stand for the law and build the wall around the law that we talked about a little bit yesterday. And the New Testament is full of examples of ways that Jesus came into conflict with the Pharisees over the understanding of what it meant to keep the law of Moses. The Pharisees were very rigid in matters of Sabbath keeping, for example, which was well and good, except that they had missed the point of the Sabbath. Now, what did Jesus say the point of the Sabbath was? It's made for man, and Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath. He told us that. Do you remember in the 12th chapter of Matthew when Jesus was in conflict with some of these people about the Sabbath, and he cited a passage from the Old Testament? Anyone remember that? This is what the Sabbath is all about. If you had known what these words mean, Matthew 12:7, if you had known what these words mean, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent, for the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Now, what sense is the Sabbath law a law of mercy? It relieves them from work. Now, who is relieved from work on the Sabbath? Everybody, including who? Even the animals, all right? And when the law speaks of the Sabbath, there are specific exceptions enumerated for doing work on the Sabbath, such as if your animal falls in a ditch or you find someone else's animal falling in a ditch, you are to help the animal. It is a law of mercy. It's a law of mercy in several respects. One of them is that, yes, God says you should take the day off, but God specifically says in the Exodus and Deuteronomy accounts, the 20th chapter of Exodus, the 5th chapter of Deuteronomy, and the statements of the Ten Commandments there, God specifically says, you shall do no work, neither shall your maidservant or your manservant or your children or the animal that is within your gates. You shall not do any work or compel anyone that you have authority over to do any work on the Sabbath day. It's a law of mercy. When the prophets say that God said, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, that's really the only law they can be looking back to, is the law that instructs the people to have this kind of mercy on those who are under their authority, those who are under their power. But this principle of mercy is in the Sabbath law, which the Pharisees had elected to overlook. They had chosen to ignore that aspect of not just Sabbath law, but the law in general. And along with that, the Sabbath law was a law of faith. You've got to have enough confidence in God to take a day off, to spend the day in devotion rather than to spend the day in productivity, and trust that God will supply your needs. And that certainly is emphasized in the way the Sabbath commandment is given and repeated for the children of Israel. The Pharisees, though, in their concern about upholding the law and building a wall around the law, make Sabbath law far more restrictive than God had ever made it, and impose things on people that they were unable to bear, including restricting the idea of going through the grain fields and plucking a few heads and getting the husk off of that in order to eat it. They were very restrictive in their explanations of the meaning of the law. Another offshoot of the Hasidians, of course, as we come down to Roman times, are the Zealots. The Zealots are going to follow in the footprints of the Hasidians in terms of thinking that they need to be a separate, free, and independent people, that they need to have the opportunity to follow God. And the Zealots believed, or at least some of the Zealots believed, that if they would pursue action against the Romans, then they would instigate the coming of the kingdom of God. God would send his Messiah to deliver them, and they would bring about the kingdom of God by the action that they took. Now, at least nominally, some Zealots believe that. Practically, Zealots almost never struck out against Roman targets. They were far more likely to strike out against their fellow Jews who were perceived as collaborating with the Romans. They were far more likely to be vindictive against people that they didn't like among their fellow Jews than to really take any significant action against the Romans. But at any rate, as we come down this line, we come down to the place where we have the Talmudic or Rabbinic Judaism that we are familiar with today. Virtually everything of modern Judaism comes out of Pharisaic tradition, which is in some sense an heir of that Hasidian origin in the days of the Maccabees. Now, that's a little bit important to realize, because one of the things that was suggested to me in talking about this was a day in the life of the Jew in the first century. And you know, we don't know very much about a day in the life of a Jew in the first century. One of the reasons that we don't is because most of what's written about a day in the life of a Jew in the first century is written in the New Testament. The New Testament has more to say about the everyday life of Jews at this period of time than any other resource that we have available. The Talmudic writings come into being after the destruction of Jerusalem. It was mentioned the other day that it is the winners who write history, but sometimes it's just the survivors who write history. And it was the survivors of the onslaught against the Jews at Jerusalem who formed a new Sanhedrin, and many of their best and most capable leaders had died in the circumstances surrounding the destruction of Jerusalem, including the assassination of a number of the high priests and chief priests and leaders among the people by zealots and others within the city. There was a lot of conflict inside the city walls, even while the Roman army was outside the city walls. And those who did survive gathered themselves together, settling in Tiberias after a time, and began to put the traditions of the fathers down on paper, and that became the Mishnah. And then over the next couple of centuries, as that was added to and commented on, commenting on the comments, so to speak, the Talmud came into being within about six centuries within 5 centuries, because it's brought to completion basically in the 6th century of our era. And that is what modern Judaism is really based on, is Talmudic principles. We've had some discussion in talking about the history of the church about how tradition and scripture are put side by side, and really heavier weight given to tradition in many cases than to scripture. Well, the same thing has happened in terms of Judaism, the Judaism that we know in our modern era. It isn't really based on the Old Testament. And when we have descriptions of things like Passover as practiced among the ancient Jews, it really is a description of Passover as comes to us through Talmudic sources, which is to say really after the fact of the Jews of Jerusalem and all of that being overrun by the Romans. And so there are some problems in really trying to sort out just exactly what first century Judaism was all about from sources that are available to us today. There are limits as to what we can know about these things, but there are a number of clues here in the New Testament, and then again there are a number of clues in the writings that have turned up in the Dead Sea Scrolls that dovetail very well with the New Testament documents to show us that this is an accurate picture, if not at all an exhaustive picture, of Judaism at that period of time. But again, we have these various parties, and we're going to revisit this in another way by looking at some scriptures. But did I see a hand wave back there? Yeah. No. I mean, I sort of did, but not really too well. The Talmud is a collection of writings from a couple of Jewish sources, and I'm not going to try and give a real detailed description of it, but the Jews of Palestine, for want of a better description, once the Romans controlled the land as thoroughly as they did after 70 AD, those Jews saw that things were not going to be as they had been before, and they form a new Sanhedrin, a new group of 70, and they gather themselves together, and I think they settled in Tiberias. I'm not sure that that was initially where they went, but they did end up in Tiberias for a time, and they set themselves to recording the traditions of the fathers, the things that the great rabbis had been teaching and saying. And the first portion of that, as I understand it, that was written is called the Mishnah, and it is a set of basically commentaries on the law, telling us what the law means, which is according to Pharisaic tradition to a great extent. And then later generations of Jews, culminating in the 6th century of our era, added additional commentaries, commenting on the commentaries to some extent, you might say, a second portion of the Talmud, expanding on the first, expanding on the Mishnah, and giving us a number of sayings and thoughts of the rabbis of the past. So it is, in the days of Jesus, when they talk about the traditions of the fathers, they're talking about an oral tradition. And this was the effort to put the oral tradition into a written form to preserve it for future generations. That is the Talmud. And Talmudic Jews are Jews who accept the Talmud as a source of guidance and authority to tell them what Judaism is supposed to be as a means of interpreting the law. There may be others that could comment on that or give a better explanation of it than that if there's a need to. Yes. As I said, in terms of tradition, we see in church history, the history of that which is called the church, and since church just means an assembly or a gathering of people, it's a perfectly good word to use in that context. But as we see in church history, there is a growing reliance upon tradition, what's been done before being done again. I just reread a story about some monkeys, and I'm not going to try and really tell it in any detail, but the story of how if you take five monkeys, put them in a cage and hang a banana, put a ladder under the banana, and the first monkey starts to climb the ladder, you hose them all down with cold water, and then they don't do it for a while, then one of them tries again, you hose them all down with cold water. And you do that enough times, and the monkeys are going to realize they don't want anybody trying to go up the ladder, and so every time one of them goes to the ladder, they start beating on him to make him not go up the ladder because they don't want to get hosed down with cold water. So then you take out one monkey and replace him with a new monkey. You got four monkeys that have been hosed down with cold water and one that hasn't, so the one that hasn't tries to go up the ladder, the other four beat him up. And you keep this process up until all you have left in the cage is five monkeys that never got hosed down. Nevertheless, if any new monkey tries to go up the ladder, the others will beat him up. Now, where does that come from? Well, it's just the way we've always done it. And so the rules are enforced even when we don't understand what the rules are all about, because that's the way it's always been. That wasn't written about the church. That was written about corporate culture. And I had no intention of using it. It was just the backing paper for one of my overheads. I just happened to notice it this morning during Rick's class and thought about how that works. But it works with Judaism just as well as it works with the growth of Romanism or whatever other ism you want to talk about. This is a tendency that human beings fall into where tradition gains greater value than revelation, where what man has done is more significant than what God has said. And it certainly has happened in terms of the progress of Judaism through the centuries. Any other questions on this before I draw a couple of points from the sects that we have represented up here? Go ahead. They did indeed, their kingdom extended into Idumean territory, and they compelled Idumeans to convert with the sword and so forth. They had that kind of a mentality. And when we look at the hostilities that exist in the New Testament era, a lot of the excess of the Hasmoneans are reflected in the hostilities that exist in the New Testament. I mentioned yesterday that there was conflict, there was civil war between the Pharisees and Sadducees at the latter part of the Hasmonean period, the ones who supported the government, the priest-kings, versus those who supported return to the law and all of that. And in that civil war, the Pharisees prevailed for a while, and they all were calling on outside governments to lend them assistance, and it was a real disaster that was going on. And I believe, I may not remember the number correctly because I haven't looked at it in a while, but I believe that when John Hyrcanus, the last of the Hasmonean priest-kings, prevailed over the Pharisees, I think one of the things that he did was to crucify 6,000 of the Pharisees. I think that's the right number, but someone else may remember better, or I may have to go back and look that up to verify the accuracy of it. But there was a tremendous anger, a tremendous vindictiveness among the people at this time. They were looking for something, trying to make something happen that they couldn't do on their own, namely to reestablish the kingdom of David, to return to the Davidic dynasty. The Sadducees thought they were close enough with what they already had. And when we come down the line to the Herodians and the Herods are reigning, we have the same thing. They felt like they were close enough. Now, what caused the Herodians to think, well, you know, this Herod as ruler is really probably what God always meant by the kingdom of God anyway. And there were people among them who reasoned that way. Now, how could you have an individual like Herod, whether the first Herod or any of his successors, and think that they were the ones to bring in the kingdom of God? Well, it's a whole lot like things that I've heard in our own news media over the last several years. The economy is good, folks, so what difference does the rest of it make? This was the mentality of the Herodians. We've got it good. The economy's great. What's the problem? Dig in and enjoy. You know that Jesus has a knack for bringing people together. I'd like you to look with me at Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10. Verse 1. Jesus called his 12 disciples to him and gave them authority to drive out evil spirits and to heal every disease and sickness. These are the names of the 12 apostles. Now you could probably sing it, but maybe you couldn't recite it. First Simon, who is called Peter, and his brother Andrew, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector, James, son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. There are two names in that list that if this were an IQ test, you would be compelled to say, what two names do not go together? So here we go. What two names do not go together? Matthew and Simon the Zealot. Okay, those two names do not go together. Why not? Water and oil. Matthew is necessarily numbered among the Herodians. He is a supporter of the government of Herod. He is necessarily sitting in his tax collection booth there and collecting taxes for Herod, collecting taxes for the Roman government that stands behind Herod. Matthew is necessarily regarded as a compromiser, a sympathizer, one who does not know or respect the law. The Pharisees would have no respect for him. What are the two words that we have linked together? Tax collectors and sinners. Tax collectors and sinners. Publicans and sinners. They go hand in hand, side by side. We're talking about people who don't know what they ought to be doing, or if they do know it, they aren't doing it. Matthew's one of those people until he follows Jesus. Meanwhile, we have Simon the Zealot. What's his philosophy? Let's kill them, particularly let's kill the collaborators. They're not too great at organizing attacks against the Roman army itself, but they're pretty good about attacking their neighbors when they don't approve of the things their neighbors are doing. And so Simon the Zealot has adopted the philosophy that the Romans don't belong here, and we ought to kill those Jews that collaborate with the Romans. And yet here is Jesus bringing together Matthew the tax collector and Simon the Zealot. And they both support his teaching. They both support his mission. I wonder if they were ever coupled together and sent out two by two. I don't know. Quinn. Well, I think there's an error there, honestly. He is Simon Zelotes, and does it also have that? I don't know what it has in Luke chapter 6. Would you like to look and see what it has there? In verse 14 or 15, verse 15. Okay, so we have him, Simon the Zealot, in 6:15 at any rate. All right. Marvin? Slept between them, huh? Well, I think the Lord spends a lot of time between his people, and with good reason. Jesus brings people together who otherwise would be hostile to each other. We've had reference earlier to some of those kinds of things stated in other scriptures, where there is neither Jew nor Greek, neither male nor female, bond or free. Those kinds of differences don't mean anything in the context of being a disciple of Jesus Christ, zealot or tax collector. Those kinds of differences are annihilated by being a disciple of Christ, or at least they're supposed to be. But these aren't the only people that Jesus brings together, and that's why we still have this rather crude chart up on the screen here. There are some other people that Jesus brings together that I wanted you to notice. Go with me to Mark chapter 3 and verse 6. I'm going to start in verse 1 to set the stage. Another time, Jesus went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath. Jesus said to the man with a shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." Then Jesus asked them, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" But they remained silent. So he looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. He said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. All right, who else does Jesus bring together? The Pharisees and the Herodians. Now, the Pharisees are over here in the God party, you might say, and the Herodians are over here in the secular party. I mean, they are the ones who say, let's follow the Romans, it's a good life, plenty of opportunities for everyone, let's support Herod as king. And the Pharisees are over here, and they're saying, we don't want to be under the Romans, we just want to be under God, we want to be left alone. Now, they are on opposite ends of the political and spiritual spectrum, and yet, when it comes to Jesus Christ, they're in the same place. Now, why is that? All right, they're drawn together in common cause against what they perceive as a common threat, a common enemy. Look at Matthew chapter 16, verse 1. Matthew 16 and 1. Now, before I read that, do you remember what Jesus' reaction was to the people who were testing him there that day in the synagogue? Okay, he was distressed by what? By the hardness of their hearts. He was distressed by the hardness of their hearts. They didn't care about the man. But he, the Son of David, had come to show mercy. The Pharisees and Sadducees came to Jesus and tested him by asking him to show them a sign from heaven. Who has Jesus brought together? The Pharisees and the Sadducees. Tell me some of the differences between Pharisees and Sadducees. Resurrection, that's a difference. Sadducees said there is no resurrection. The Pharisees asserted that there certainly would be a resurrection. What else? Angels, spiritual things, miracles. The Sadducees, it's not exactly sufficient to describe them as deists, but that's largely what they were. They didn't deny the existence of God. They just denied his involvement. They weren't interested in a God who was involved with his people. That wasn't the kind of God they believed in, because after all, they had wealth and power already. And they were some of those who put trust in their riches. And there are lots of indicators of that, including a particular Sadducee named Caiaphas, whose tomb seems to have been found a couple of years ago over in Israel. And his burial reflected both the opulence and the Hellenistic influence of his lifestyle, the way that he had lived as a man. So Jesus brought together Pharisees and Sadducees. Now, they had very different religious and political views, but they could unite on one thing. They didn't like Jesus. That brought them together. Go with me to Luke chapter 23. We have here the assembly that brings Jesus to Pilate, accusing him of being a source of subversion, insurrection, opposing payment of taxes to Caesar, claiming to be Christ the King. Pilate examined Jesus and basically came to the place where he felt like this was a waste of time. And then he learned that because this was, after all, Passover season and a very important event in Jewish life, verse 7, he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction. He sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. Now, Herod did not rule in Jerusalem. He ruled from Sepphoris at this time, up in the Galilee. But Herod was in Jerusalem for Passover, and when Pilate realized that he was there and that Jesus was a Galilean, he decided, I'll just give this case to Herod. And he sent him. Herod was delighted. Verse 8, when Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. Now, why had he been wanting to see him? Wanted to see a miracle, and who did he think Jesus might be? John the Baptist, whom he had ordered executed. Herod had believed that John truly was a prophet of God. He had been fearful of John, but he was more fearful of his own cronies and the people around him. He had made a rash promise to his stepdaughter, and that promise had resulted in the death of John the Baptist because Herod, much like King Saul, was unwilling to take a stand for principle. He acquiesced to the desires of the people around him and demanded the death of John the Baptist, required the death of John the Baptist. However, as John the Baptist faded from the scene, being dead, he began to hear stories of Jesus and the works and the miracles that he was doing, and so Herod had this queasy feeling within himself that perhaps John wasn't really dead after all. Maybe John had come back, and maybe Herod would have additional problems with John because his religion seems to have been what we might call superstition. He was a fearful man, as his father before him had been, but didn't act in any appropriate way to come to terms with those fears. So Herod was delighted to have the chance to see Jesus. And he thought maybe he would learn the truth about Jesus at last, but Jesus was uncooperative. Jesus wouldn't perform tricks for him. And so Herod was disillusioned. He ordered his soldiers, or he had his soldiers participate with him in ridiculing and mocking Jesus, making fun of him as the King of the Jews, and then sent him back to Pilate. Verse 12, that day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. Who did Jesus bring together? Herod and Pilate, two men who had previously despised each other. Well, after this, they had a lot in common because both of them were deposed by the Romans and both of them were sent into exile and died in obscurity. So they had a lot to celebrate together after their collusion against Jesus. But that day, they became friends because of their shared antipathy toward what would happen to this innocent man. They agreed that there was no cause for a death sentence against him, but they cared nothing for the life of this man. Neither of them did. And they became friends over this incident, this collusion together over the life of an innocent man. Before this, they had been enemies. Well, it seems to me, and we're going to go to Matthew 22 to look at another final instance of this sort of thing that just rings out the very same thing that we've already been noticing. Matthew chapter 22, verse 15, the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap Jesus in his words. Did they succeed? No, they didn't succeed. The Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap him in his words. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. Well, see, this is quite some time after the incident in Mark chapter 3 there where the Herodians and Pharisees plotted how to take his life. This is a long-term alliance that these people have something in common in trying to get rid of Jesus, because this is the final week of Jesus' life. This is Jesus in Jerusalem going steadfastly toward the cross. Teacher, they said, we know that you are a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are. Tell us then what your opinion is. Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? What'd they start with? Flattery. We had something about that last week. Flattery. They started with flattery. Now, is what they said true or untrue? True. But did they say it because it was true? Why'd they say it? To distract him, to get his guard down. Do you suppose it worked real well? He knew who he was talking to. This is ridiculous. But people do this all the time. Try and flatter someone, butter the bread a little bit so that they'll get the outcome that they want. And so they ask him about paying taxes to Caesar. Now the Pharisees and the Herodians are both there, and there's a little bit of significance to that, because what kind of answer could Jesus give to this question? Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Well, there's two possible answers, they suppose, since it's a yes or no question. He could say yes or no. If he says, yes, it's right to pay taxes to Caesar, then who has their arguments all lined up to make him look like a fool? Pharisees do. If he says, no, it's not right to pay taxes to Caesar, who has the arguments ready to go? The Herodians. Because they've argued this thing back and forth for a long time, and so they're all set to make Jesus look silly no matter what answer he gives. But Jesus didn't give them a yes or no answer. Jesus says instead, let's have a look at a coin. You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? He says they're wearing a mask. They're pretending to be something they are not. Show me the coin used for paying the tax. They brought him the denarius, and he asked them, whose portrait is this and whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. He said to them, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. And when they heard this, they were amazed. So they left him and went away. They didn't have an argument to deliver. Neither side had an argument to deliver, because he had given them an answer that did not play into the normal routine of their discussions against one another. We continue on down in the chapter, and the next thing we have in verse 23 is the same day, the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him. And they think they've got a conundrum that he cannot answer. But, of course, he answered it. He told them that they had failed to understand the scriptures, and they didn't really know who God is. Verse 29. You are in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God. Well, that's right. They don't. Verse 33, when the crowds heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. And verse 34, hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question. And they come back with another question. And then verse 41, Jesus turns it around and asks them a question. And at that point in time, verse 46, no one could say a word in reply, and from that day on, no one dared to ask him any more questions. Was that the end of the alliance? Was that the end of the opposition? No, but they realized they weren't going to talk him to death. And so they set out to put him to death. But we have a tag team going here. We have the Herodians, we have the Pharisees, we have the Sadducees, people who come from very different political perspectives, very different religious perspectives, but they have one thing in common. They are opposed to Jesus Christ. It's a whole lot like America in the year 2000 with all of the different forces out there that will rally together for one cause. Go ahead, Tom. The scribes, by and large, would be over here among the Pharisees. They would be, by and large, not in every case, but by and large, the scribes would be aligned with the Pharisees. I know, and I answered scribes. Yeah, on purpose. Yeah, very often the reference to lawyers is talking about people who know the law intimately from having been involved in its copying. Now, there are exceptions to that, those who argue the law, but generally speaking, we're talking about those who would be aligned with the Pharisees. That's right. And as we come down to the bottom of the chart there with rabbinic Judaism growing out of these roots, when we talk about rabbis, by and large, we're talking about Pharisees. Not in every case, but by and large we are. Because after all, they're the ones who really care about what the law says and who want to get it right down to the last detail, down to the last nitty-gritty determination of every detail. And so for the most part, when we talk about the rabbis, we are talking about the Pharisees in those early days. Not in every case, because after all, Jesus is called rabbi a number of times. That point was made the other day, and he certainly didn't fit into the category of the Pharisees. Although he did believe in angels and the resurrection, he certainly did not fit into the category of the Pharisees. So Jesus does bring people together, right? He brings together Simon and Matthew. From utterly opposing points of view, he brings them together in harmony. But he also brings together the Herodians and the Pharisees and the Sadducees and Herod and Pilate. He also brings them together. He brings them together into two very different camps. But really the world is divided into those two camps. Those who stand with Jesus and those who stand in opposition to him. And whether you are a Herodian or a Pharisee, whether you stand in this place or that place politically, is irrelevant. If you stand in opposition to Jesus, you're in the wrong camp. And if you stand in support of Jesus, if you stand under the blood of Jesus, which is where we truly need to be, then you're in the right camp. Now, by all the indicators of the way the gospel story turns out, which camp had the more power? Well, I guess that depends on what you mean by the way the gospel story turned out. Because at the end of the story here, if we only go as far as the gospel account, Jesus is put to death, and the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Herodians go right on along with what they've been fussing about all along. But that's not the end of the story by any means, is it? Because although I say that Talmudic rabbinic Judaism grew out of the traditions of the Pharisees, where is the Sadducee today? Or the Pharisee today? Or the Zealot today? I mean, we have similar movements. We have people with similar agendas and similar mindsets. But in fact, the cross triumphed over all of these ideas and movements and brought them to an end. And it was a bitter end indeed. And to the last, once Jesus was no longer the common adversary in a way that they could handle, of course, they used the church that way for a time. But once Jesus was no longer there, and they focused on their own individual agendas and purposes, and I'd love to spend time talking a lot about Jerusalem in its last days, it was chaos, and it was self-destruction, which is what the enemies of Jesus really always bring upon themselves. It's self-destruction to stand opposed to Jesus of Nazareth. But Jesus polarizes people. Either you are with him or you are against him. Simon and Matthew were able to put aside their differences by adopting the common cause of Jesus Christ. And that's where we want to find ourselves today. In common cause, under the authority and leadership of Jesus Christ, in common cause with Jesus Christ. Any questions or comments before I put up something about the Herods? Go ahead, Glenn.
Thank you.
And by the way, that's S-C-C-T-S. Yes, there is. Dwayne?
How far does it extend to those Jews that were dispersed?
Well, you know, it influenced those Jews that were dispersed, because when Paul would write to the Philippians, for example, he would say, I was a Pharisee, and I mean, he would explain these things in the same terms as you would have in Judea. And so these ideas were certainly known throughout the dispersion of the Jews. And another way of thinking about that is when Paul went out from Jerusalem with letters to the synagogues in Syria, in Damascus, that authority would be respected. The temple was a tremendously important focal point for Judaism. And so the general description that we have here influences the whole flow of Judaism for future generations. Go ahead, Chad. In fact, who were the first people who came to celebrate the birth of Jesus? The shepherds. Now, that's a sidelight. I didn't know if I would ever work it into the lesson, but I'll work it in here right now. The shepherds. Where do the shepherds stand in this scheme of things? Well, they're out of there. They don't belong in there at all in this scheme of things. I mean, they're Jews, but they don't have any standing. They don't have any status. When the Pharisees looked at shepherds, they had no respect for them at all. Isn't that bizarre, given all the things the Old Testament has to say about shepherds even before the time of David? You know, Moses appealing to God that he would provide a leader so that his people would not be like sheep without a shepherd, and going all the way back to Abel, a keeper of flocks. Shepherds are held in esteem in the Scriptures. Why? In the minds of the Pharisees, shepherds were people not just of low degree, but they were categorically sinners. You know why that would be? Sin and rewards, because their status in life was low, so there must be something wrong with them. Well, that sounds almost like a doctrine of reincarnation. But yeah, it's kind of a caste perspective, but there's more than that. They are ignorant people. They don't have the training in the law. That's part of it. They don't spend the time in devotion. Well, unless they have devotions out on the hills. But how many days a week does a shepherd work? 7 days a week. 7 days a week. Now, what's the Pharisaic position on the Sabbath? Now, it isn't just you don't work on the seventh day, because that's the position of the law, but that you don't do any work on the seventh day, even the work of mercy, even the work of guiding and guarding, which the shepherd's work is. And so the shepherds are despised by the Pharisees. And yet, what does Jesus teach about himself and those who will be his followers? I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd knows his sheep and calls them each by name. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. We have the parable of the lost sheep. Jesus uses this illustration a number of times to convey the relationship between himself, the Son of God, and his people, those who become the children of God through him. But this is an attitude that the Pharisees really could not identify with, because they didn't care for shepherds. They felt that the shepherds were outside of the providence of those who could possibly be keeping the law. Jesus didn't do the power brokers. That is. And it's really hard to talk about the Herods in an effective way in any amount of time, because it is such a confused mess. But they figure largely in several of the stories of Jesus. Well, I had another copy of that to look at myself, but I'll just look at the one on the screen because it got away from me, Jay. I'm not interested in the map on top. I'm really just interested in the chart down below. So slide up right about there. That's good. Okay. Over on this side, we have Herod the Great. He's the one who became the king of Judea in 37 B.C. The Romans had said he could be in 40, but it took him 3 years to get the Jews to see it his way. And so in 37 B.C., he became in fact, the king of Judea, the Galilee, and surrounding regions there. Jesus was born in his lifetime. This is the Herod who is mentioned in Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 19, the story there of the slaughter of the innocents in Jerusalem, in Bethlehem, rather, and then also in Luke 1:5. Herod the Great is the Herod who is reigning at the time of Jesus' birth, that Joseph and Mary flee in going down into Egypt. Well, Herod the Great had 10 wives and 15 sons, and it's a little hard for me to keep all that sorted out. So this is just a microcosm of that. In fact, this is directly out of the NIV Study Bible. I used that simply because I have it with me, and I wanted this chart for today and hadn't brought anything like that. So this is just out of a chart that the NIV Study Bible uses. Now, there are several of Herod's children that are important to us in the biblical scheme of things. One of those is Herod Antipas, and he is the Herod that we just read about in the 23rd chapter of Luke, as it says right there on the screen. He is the Herod that we just read about in the 23rd chapter of Luke. He is the Herod who put John the Baptist to death. He is the son of Herod the Great. His mother was a woman named Malthus, or something like that, and she was a Samaritan. She was a Samaritan. Now, Herod had married some Jewish women. He had married one named Miriam, who was the granddaughter of John Hyrcanus, who was the last of the Hasmonean kings. And he had done that in order to reaffirm his claim to the throne of the Jews, to the throne of Israel, so to speak, that he had a legitimate right to that throne, not only by Roman decree, but also by being a member of the right family. And the Hasmonean dynasty had reigned for some 80 years. So he married the granddaughter of John Hyrcanus. However, in the passage of time, the two sons that were born to him from this woman, Miriam, his mind was poisoned against them by another of his sons. I believe Aristobulus was the one who did the poisoning. But at any rate, he ended up ordering those two sons to be executed. Miriam didn't take that too well, so eventually he decided he couldn't trust her either, and he had her put to death. There was a point in time when Herod's good friend Augustus Caesar said of him that it would be better to be Herod's hog than to be Herod's son. Now, that was a play on words. It was based on the fact that Herod had a tendency to kill his sons. The word for hog in Greek and the word for son in Greek sound almost the same. They're very similar words. And since Herod went through the motions of Jewishness, he would be far less likely to kill a hog than he would to put one of his own sons to death. And he did order the death of several of his relatives, wives, mothers-in-law, children, and so forth. He was a wretched man. Herod Antipas does not win any real prizes for being a great man either. He gets into trouble with John the Baptist, you remember, because he takes Herodias to be his wife. Now, Herodias is the granddaughter of Herod the Great, so she is the niece of Herod Antipas, and she is first the wife of Herod Philip. Now, Herod Philip is not mentioned to us specifically in the Bible except as the husband of Herodias, that Herod had taken his brother Philip's wife. This Philip, Herod Philip, lived in Rome and did not ever reign in the land of Canaan there, the promised land where the Jews lived. He was the son of a woman named Miriam, and this Miriam, not the granddaughter of John Hyrcanus, but rather the daughter of Simon, who was one of the high priests of the Jews, was the mother of a couple of other children. We also have up here another Herod Philip. I don't know why in the world parents would give more than one of their children the same name, but it happened. We have up here another Herod Philip, and this is the Philip who is the tetrarch who is mentioned in the scriptures in Luke chapter 3, verse 1. He is the one who's reigning in the area of Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi is built by this Philip and is named after him and is built in honor of Caesar. And so he enters the Bible story somewhat. Archelaus is the son of Herod, who was his immediate successor. And we have Archelaus ruling at the time when Jesus' parents return to Nazareth. They don't go back to Bethlehem because they have heard that Archelaus is ruling in the place of his father. Matthew 2, 19 through 23 has that story. And they figure that Archelaus is likely to pick up where Herod the Great had left off, and so they go to the Galilee instead, which is the region where Herod Antipas is going to be ruling. Got all that straight? Okay. I figured that you probably would. The thing about Archelaus that I want to kind of mention to you without going into any particular detail on it is in Luke chapter 19. Luke chapter 19. We're going to come back to the Herods, but I wanted to use Archelaus as a springboard just to make a comment about the way that Jesus used parables. Luke chapter 19, verse 11. Well, before I read verse 11, according to verse 1 of Luke 19, where was Jesus at this time?
Jericho.
Jesus entered Jericho. He'd gone down the Jericho Road that we sang about this morning. Where was he going to when he went down the Jericho Road? Jericho wasn't his real destination. Where was he going?
Jerusalem.
He's on his way to Jerusalem for that final confrontation. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. Verse 11. While they were listening to this about Zacchaeus and how Jesus had come to seek and save the lost, while they were listening to this, he went on to tell them a parable because he was near Jerusalem and the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once. He said, a man of noble birth went to a distant country to have himself appointed king and then to return. So he called 10 of his servants and gave them 10 minas. Put this money to work, he said, until I come back. But his subjects hated him and sent a delegation after him to say, we don't want this man to be our king. Now, if we stopped right there, or even if we go on to verse 15, he was made king, however, and returned home, and then he sent for his servants. If we didn't go on with what Jesus says, everybody that was listening to Jesus would have said, well, we already know this story, because it is the story of Archelaus, wherever he went on the screen up there. It is the story of Archelaus. Archelaus was the man named by his father Herod the Great to assume the rulership of his kingdom. But his relatives contested the will, and they went to Rome to protest Archelaus being made king. And so Archelaus went to a distant country. He went to Rome in order to secure his kingdom. And while he was there in Rome, leaving things in the hands of trusted stewards at home, some of his, some of his servants, some of the people who were responsible to him, a delegation was sent from Jerusalem to Rome to argue the case for Herod Antipas to be their ruler instead of Herod Archelaus, or else to have the Romans just establish a separate rule with no Herods at all ruling over them. But they did not want Herod Archelaus to be their king. And Antipas came and pressed this case. He was the one who had caused Herod Archelaus to have to do this in the first place. But at any rate, the outcome of that was that Archelaus won his case. He was made king. He was sent back with the power of Rome behind him. And he reigned for about 10 years, from 4 BC to 6 AD, he reigned. So when Jesus is in Jericho, one of the things about Jericho is that there is a palace there that was built by Herod Archelaus. And there's very little doubt that this was the reason that Jesus chose this place. This is where Archelaus had his home. This is the place where he centered his power and authority and wealth and his extravagances and abuses as well, because he was really a wretched, wicked man. He was a terrible, abusive ruler, and the people despised him and did not want to serve him. But this was his seat of power in Jericho, where Jesus chose to tell this story. This story is a parable, and Jesus goes on to draw an analogy out of it, but it is a parable that is based on real events that those people would all be aware of, because after all, this is around 30 AD, and these things had taken place one generation earlier, and so they would all be familiar with the politics of the story, the events that took place, and so forth. Now, Jesus is illustrating something about the kingdom of God by telling a story of a very wretched man, but drawing from the circumstances of that man's life an illustration of how it is with him. Because his people don't like him either. And they don't want him to be king either. And there are those who do everything they can to prevent him from taking the throne. But guess what? He's going to go away, and then he's going to come back. And when he comes back, he will be king. It won't be stopped. His opponents will not win. And so then we have the review of how he dealt with the 10 servants. The king, on his return, dealt with his 10 servants and the way they had handled the money that he had entrusted to them. The first one came and said, I took your mina and I earned 10 more. And he said, well, then you'll be in charge of 10 cities. And the second one came and said, I took your mina and I earned 5 more. And he said, well, then you'll be in charge of 5 cities. And the third one came and said, I took your mina and I hid it because I was afraid, because I know you're a hard man, very much like the story in the parable of the talents. But the setting for this one here in the city of Jericho is very appropriate to the circumstances and the recent history these people would know about. And as Jesus winds down this parable and tells us about what it all means, he says that it's going to be this way, that when he comes, the one who has not done anything is going to lose even what he had, and the ones who have opposed him are going to be destroyed. Those enemies of mine who did not want me to be king over them, bring them to me, bring them here and kill them in front of me. It's an illustration of a hard reality that you oppose the king and you're going to lose, and he is the true king. He is the one who has the mandate, not from Rome, but from heaven, to be the king of Israel. And in thinking about this, I wanted to use this as an opportunity to review the idea of what parables are. Jesus told somewhere between 40 and 50 of them during his, well, no, I don't know how many he told. We have between 40 and 50 of them recorded in the New Testament. And it depends a little bit on how you count them as to the number that you come up with. When Jesus tells his stories in different places, do you count this as being the same parable as the parable of the talents, or do you count it as being two different parables? So he used about 40 or 50 parables that were recorded for us in the Gospels. But what is a parable? What does that mean to say an earthly story with a heavenly meaning? What do you mean an earthly story? Something you can connect to, something that deals with the familiar, the ordinary, the everyday. Okay? Say again? An analogy. It is an analogy. It draws a comparison between ordinary things that we already know about and things that we do not yet comprehend or have not yet seen. Things that will be true. Things that have to do with eternal values. And that's why the description of an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. It's about ordinary everyday things. And Jesus tells lots of stories about ordinary everyday things. I said I was going to go back to the Herods, but I'm going to have to pick that up tomorrow because we don't have time to talk about the last couple of them. Not that they're terribly important to our storyline, but just to realize the different ones that Jesus interacted with. Regarding parables, though, I do want us to remember, in thinking about Jesus, you already know it, but remember that he was quite a storyteller when it came to him being a teacher. He is regarded as the greatest teacher who ever lived, and I think rightly so. And consider how much of his teaching was couched in the form of storytelling. He told people stories to illustrate ideas. And many of us here have an opportunity to teach people. I think we would do well to borrow from Jesus the concept of using stories in our teaching techniques. There are lots of biblical stories to draw on, lots of which have obvious moral import and lessons to teach. But stories are a very important part of effective teaching and equipping people to learn by motivating their interest. And Jesus certainly used them consistently and used them well to stir the minds of his hearers. And those stories, I think it's well attested, the idea in the New Testament and the reality that we know, those stories, even when the meaning did not gel at once, the story itself would be remembered so that the meaning might be arrived at later by meditation and consideration. And I'll leave that with you today. I understand that unless something else has come up, there are no particular announcements to make other than the reminder of a meeting at 7 o'clock tonight. Brother Richard Riggins will be our speaker tonight, and he has a message about the work of the Holy Spirit. And I personally look forward to hearing about that from him. If there isn't anything else, I'm going to... Our language, it's a term that we recognize readily enough because the beginning of the word there is zeal, zealot, and we recognize the significance of the word zeal, one who is full of commitment and enthusiasm, one who has a strong determination. And the 10th chapter of Matthew, depending on what Bible you're reading, my Bible, the NIV, calls him again in this passage, Simon the Zealot, in chapter 10, verse 4. And what they've done in the NIV in this particular case is they have translated the Greek word that occurs there, which is a transliterated Aramaic word. This is not the Aramaic or the Greek word, but if I write up here, and if you happen to be one of those who's able to see the board, two words, can you tell the difference between those two words? Lewis Garvey, I'm going to pick on you. What's that word? Ken. What's that mean? No idea. Somebody help us out here. A relative, someone you're related to. I'm not done with you yet, though, Lewis. What's this word? Chin. What's that word mean? Lower part of your face. You don't have any problem recognizing the difference in those two words, right? Because, well, I mean, they look a lot alike, but they're not the same word. The same is the case with the word that we have here in Matthew chapter 10, verse 4. I'm going to compare it to another word, even though we're not looking at the Greek language, and I have no intention of spending time on that. But look at Matthew chapter 15 and verse 22. Matthew 15 and 22. We have the a reference to a woman there. What kind of a woman is she? Canaanite woman there in the region of Syro-Phoenicia. All right. She is a Canaanite woman. Now, in the Greek text there, where we're talking about the Canaanite woman, that is the word we have, the equivalent in the Old Testament, Canaanite. The way that it's spelled in the Greek text is the equivalent of C-H-A-N, etc. All right. It's the Greek letter T. On the other hand, in Matthew 10 and 4, you really wanted a language lesson, didn't you? A little bit about etymology and all that. In Matthew 10 and 4, the word that we're looking at is a word that begins with the Greek letter kappa, T, okay, kappa, and then it is, again, A-N-A that we're looking at there. This is an Aramaic word that Matthew and Mark both use. It's an Aramaic word that means zeal, okay? And so Simon is being described here as a zealot. The difficulty that comes in is that when the King James was translated, they didn't render this as the Revised Standard, K-N-A-M-E-N, with 1A in there. They didn't render it as a good transliteration of the original. They rendered it as though it were the name Canaanite, at least in the King James I've looked at, and so it gets a little bit confusing. Did Jesus have any Canaanite disciples? No. His disciples were all of the house of Israel. There's no question about that. He went to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. There's no doubt about that. And the Greek is actually very clear on that, the distinction that we're talking about an Aramaic word here in Matthew and Mark that comes into the Greek language by transliteration, but gets a little bit confused sometimes in the English. And you know, the funny thing, I looked at three different New King James versions to see. The first one I looked at had Canaanite with the two A's in Matthew 10:4, and then it had Canaanite with A-N-A in Mark chapter 8, where Mark's account of this is given. Is that right? Mark 3:8. That's where the 8 came from. Okay. No, that doesn't look right. I don't know. Yes, Mark 3:18. Okay. At any rate, I found when I looked at the first New King James Version that I looked at that it had it one way in Matthew and another way in Mark, even though it's the same word. The second New King James I looked at, it had it as Canaanite in both passages, and then the third one that I looked at, it had it as with the 1A in the two places in both passages, so I don't know just exactly what the newest current edition of the New King James Version has on that, but at any rate, there's a little bit of confusion on the part of the translators is what's going on there, and that's the kind of error I'm talking about, is a translator's error in conveying that word in an understandable way to the English reading audience. Now, that was a lot of ado about something that maybe you didn't care anything about, but I wanted to either clarify it or muddy up the waters, whichever way it came out for you. I wanted to try and touch on that a little bit, because I don't like to leave a misapprehension about the value and authenticity of the text of the Scriptures, which I hold on a very high level of esteem. Yes? It would be transliterated as zealotes. Yeah. Yes. The